clipped words and cool voices and firm handshakes. She'd lost track of the times an American had hugged her so tightly she'd come off her feet. "I'm Juliet," she said to the major. Major Jack Foley was next to arrive. He gave her a big smile and said,
"Those are some mountains." "You said a mouthful there," Dowd said, thrusting his hand out. "Dowd, Chicago."
"Foley,
Boston."
"Nice to meet you."
Sergeant Smythe brought up the rear. He arrived a few minutes later.
"Hello, gentlemen," he said stiffly. "That was a hike."
"Just wait,"
Isabel said with a laugh. She led them to the cottage and knocked three times on the front door. Madame Babineau opened the door a little, saw Isabel through the crack and grinned, stepping back to allow them entrance. As always, a cast-iron cauldron hung above the flames in the soot-blackened fireplace. The table was set for their arrival, with glasses of warm milk and empty soup bowls. Isabel glanced around.
"Eduardo?"
"In the barn, with two more airmen. We are having trouble getting supplies. It's all this damned bombing. Half of town is rubble."
She placed a hand on Isabel's cheek.
"You look tired, Isabel. Are you well?"
The touch was so comforting that Isabel couldn't help leaning into it for just a moment. She wanted to tell her friend her troubles, unburden herself for a moment. But that was another luxury lost in this war. Troubles were carried alone. Isabel didn't tell Madame Babineau that the Gestapo had broadened their search for the Nightingale, or that she worried for her father and sister and niece. What was the point? They all had family to worry about. Such were ordinary anxieties, fixed points on the map of this war. Isabel reached out for the old woman's hands. There were so many terrible aspects to what their lives were now, but there was this, too. Friendships, forged in fire that had proven to be as strong as iron. After so many solitary years, spent tucked away in convents and forgotten in boarding schools, Isabel never took for granted the fact that she now had friends. People whom she cared about, and who cared about her.
"I am fine, my friend."
"And that handsome man of yours?"
"Still bombing depots and derailing trains. I saw him just before the invasion at Normandy. I could tell something big was up. I know he's in the thick of it. I'm worried."
Isabel heard the distant purr of an engine. She turned to Madame.
"Are you expecting anyone?"
"No one ever drives up here."
The airmen heard it too. They paused in their conversation. Smythe looked up. Foley drew a knife out of his waistband. Outside, the goat started bleating. A shadow moved across the window. Before Isabel could yell out a warning, the door smacked open and light poured into the room, along with several SS agents.
"Put your hands over your heads!"
Isabel was hit hard in the back of the head by a rifle butt. She gasped and stumbled forward. Her legs gave out beneath her and she fell hard, cracking her head on the stone floor. The last thing she heard before she lost consciousness was,
"You are all under arrest."
Chapter 33. Isabel woke tied to a wooden chair at her wrists and ankles. The ropes bit into her flesh and were so tight she couldn't move. Her fingers were numb. A single light bulb hung from the ceiling above her, a cone of light in the darkness. The room smelled of mold and piss and water seeping through cracks in the stone. Somewhere in front of her, a match flared. She heard the scratch of sound, smelled the sulfur, and tried to lift her head, but the movement hurt so much she made an involuntary sound.
"Good,"
someone said.
"It hurts."
Gestapo. He pulled a chair from the darkness and sat down, facing her.
"Pain?"
he said simply.
"Or no pain?" The choice is yours.
In that case, no pain.
He hit her hard. Blood filled her mouth, sharp and metallic tasting. She felt it dribble down her chin.
2 days, she thought. Only 2 days.
She had to last under questioning for 48 hours without naming names. If she could do that, just not crack, her father and Gaetan and Henri and Didier and Paul and Anouk would have time to protect themselves. They would know soon that she had been arrested if they didn't already know. Eduardo would get the word out, and then he would go into hiding. That was their plan.
Name, he said,
withdrawing a small notebook and a pencil from his breast pocket. She felt blood dripping down her chin onto her lap.
Juliette Gervaise. But you know that. You have my papers.
They have papers that name you as Juliette Gervaise, true.
So why ask me?
Who are you really?
I'm really Juliette.
Bon fair,
he asked lazily, studying his well-tended fingernails.
Nice.
And what were you doing in Auvergne?
I was in Auvergne, she said.
He straightened at that. His gaze returned to hers with interest.
How old are you?
22, or nearly, I think. Birthdays don't mean much anymore.
You look younger.
I feel older.
He slowly got to his feet, towered over her.
You work for the Nightingale. I want his name.
They didn't know who she was.
I know nothing about birds.
The blow came out of the blue, stunning in its impact. Her head whipped sideways, cracked hard against the chair back.
Tell me about the Nightingale.
I told you.
This time he hit her with an iron ruler across the cheek, so hard she felt her skin break open and blood spill. He smiled and said again,
The Nightingale.
She spat as hard as she could, but it came out as a dribbling blob of blood that landed in her lap. She shook her head to clear her vision and wished immediately that she hadn't. He was coming toward her again, methodically slapping the red dripping ruler into his open palm.
I'm Rittmeister Schmidt, commandant of the Gestapo in Amboise. And you are?
He is going to kill me,
Isabel thought. She struggled against her restraints, breathing hard. She tasted her own blood.
Juliet,
she whispered, desperate now that he believe her. She couldn't last 2 days. This was the risk everyone had warned her about, the terrible truth of what she'd been doing. How had it seemed like an adventure? She would get herself and everyone she cared about killed.
We have most of your compatriots. There is no sense in you dying to protect dead men.
Was it true? No. If it were true, she would be dead too.
Juliette Gervaise,
she said again. He backhanded her with the ruler so hard the chair toppled sideways and crashed to the floor. Her head cracked on the stone at the same time he kicked her in the stomach with the toe of his boot. The pain was like nothing she'd ever known. She heard him say,
Now, mademoiselle, name the Nightingale.
And she couldn't have answered if she wanted to. He kicked her again, with all his weight behind the blow. Consciousness brought pain. Everything hurt. Her head, her face, her body. It took effort and courage to lift her head. She was still bound at the ankles and wrists. The ropes chafed against her torn, bloodied skin, cut into her bruised flesh.
Where am I?
Darkness surrounded her, and not an ordinary darkness, not an unlit room. This was something else. An impenetrable, inky blackness that pressed against her battered face. She sensed a wall was mere inches from her face. She tried to make the smallest move of her foot to reach forward, and pain roared to life again, biting deep into the rope cuts on her ankles. She was in a box. And she was cold. She could feel her breath and knew it would be visible. Her nostril hairs were frozen. She shivered hard, uncontrollably. She screamed in terror. The sound of her scream echoed back at her and was lost. Freezing. Isabel shuddered with cold, whimpering. She could feel her breath now, pluming in front of her face, turning to frost on her lips. Her eyelashes were frozen.
Think, Isabel. Don't give up.
She moved her body a little, fighting through the cold and pain. She was seated, still bound at the ankles and wrists. Naked. She closed her eyes, sickened by the image of him undressing her, touching her when she was unconscious. In the fetid darkness, she became aware of a thrumming noise. At first, she thought it was her blood, pulsing in pain, or her heart, pounding a desperate beat to stay alive. But it wasn't that. It was a motor. And nearby, humming. She recognized the sound. But what was it? She shuddered again, trying to wiggle her fingers and toes to combat the dead feeling that had overtaken her extremities. Before there was pain in her feet, and then a tingling. And now, nothing. She moved the only thing she could, her head, and it thunked against something hard. She was naked, tied to a chair, inside a frozen, dark, humming, small, a refrigerator. She panicked, tried frantically to wrest free, to topple her prison, but all her effort did was wind her, defeat her. She couldn't move. Not anything except her fingers and toes, which were too frozen to cooperate.
Not like this, please.
She would freeze to death, or be asphyxiated. Her own breathing echoed back at her, surrounded her, a shudder of breath all around it. She started to cry, and her tears froze, turning to icicles on her cheeks. She thought of all the people she loved. Vianne, Sophie, Gaetan, her father. Why hadn't she told them she loved them every day when she had the chance? And now she would die without ever saying a word to Vianne. Vianne, she thought. Only that. The name. Part prayer, part regret, part goodbye. A dead body hung from every street lamp in the town square. Vianne came to a stop, unable to believe what she was seeing. Across the way, an old woman stood beneath one of the bodies. The air was full of the whining creak of ropes pulled taut. Vianne moved cautiously through the square, taking care to keep away from the street lamps. Blue-faced, swollen, slack bodies. There had to be 10 dead men here. Frenchmen, she could tell. Maquisard by the look of them. The rough guerrilla partisans of the woods. They wore brown pants and black berets and tricolor armbands. Vianne went to the old woman, took her by the shoulders.
You should not be here, she said.
My son, the woman croaked. He can't stay here.
Come, Vianne said, less gently this time. She maneuvered the old woman out of the square. En Rue La Grande, the woman pulled free and walked away, mumbling to herself, crying. Vianne passed 3 more dead bodies on her way to the boucherie. Caraveau seemed to be holding its breath. The Allies had bombed the area repeatedly in the last few months, and several of the town's buildings had been reduced to rubble. Something always seemed to be falling down or crumbling. The air smelled of death, and the town was silent. Danger lurked in every shadow, around every corner. In the queue at the butcher shop, Vianne heard women talking, their voices lowered.
Retaliation.
Worse in Toul.
Did you hear about Oradour sur Glane?
Even with all of that, with all of the arrests and deportations and executions, Vianne couldn't believe the newest rumors. Yesterday morning, the Nazis had marched into the small village of Oradour sur Glane, not far from Carrevaux, and herded everyone at gunpoint into the town's church, supposedly to check their papers.
"Everyone in town," whispered the woman to whom Vianne had spoken. "Men, women, children. The Nazis shot them all. Then they slammed the doors shut, locked them all in, and burned the church to the ground."
Her eyes welled with tears.
"It's true."
"It can't be," Vianne said. "My Didi saw them shoot a pregnant woman in the belly."
"She saw this?" Vianne asked.
The old woman nodded.
"Didi hid out for hours behind a rabbit hutch and saw the town in flames. She said she'll never forget the screaming. Not everyone was dead when they set the fire."
It was supposedly in retaliation for a Sturmbannführer who'd been captured by the Maquis. Would the same thing happen here? The next time the war went badly, would the Gestapo or SS round up the villagers of Carrevaux and trap them in the town hall and open fire? She took the small tin of oil that this week's ration card had allowed her and walked out of the shop, flipping her hood up to shield her face. Someone grabbed her by the arm and pulled her hard to the left. She stumbled sideways, lost her footing, and almost fell. He pulled her into a dark alley and revealed himself.
"Papa?"
Vianne said, too stunned by his appearance to say more. She saw what the war had done to him, how it had etched lines in his forehead and placed puffy bags of flesh beneath his tired-looking eyes, how it had leached the color from his skin and turned his hair white. He was terribly thin. Age spots dotted his sagging cheeks. She was reminded of his return from the Great War, when he'd looked this bad.
"Is there somewhere quiet we can talk?" he said. "I'd rather not meet your German."
"He's not my German, but we..."
She could hardly blame him for not wanting to meet von Richter.
"The house next door to mine is vacant. To the east. The Germans thought it too small to bother with. We can meet there."
"In 20 minutes, he said.
Vianne pulled her hood back up over her scarf-covered hair and stepped out of the alleyway. As she left town and walked along the muddy road toward home, she tried to imagine why her father was here. She knew, or supposed, that Isabel was living with him in Paris, although even that was conjecture. For all she knew, her sister and her father lived separate lives in the same city. She hadn't heard from Isabel since that terrible night in the barn, although Henri reported that she was well. She hurried past the airfield, barely noticing the aeroplanes that were crumpled and still smoking from a recent bombing raid. At Rachel's gate, she paused and glanced up and down the road. No one had followed or seemed to be watching her. She slipped inside the yard and hurried to the abandoned cottage. The front door had been broken long ago and now hung askew. She let herself inside. The interior was shadowy and limned in dust. Almost all of the furniture had been requisitioned or stolen by looters, and missing pictures left black squares on the walls. Only an old love seat with dirty cushions and a broken leg remained in the living room. Vianne sat down, perched nervously, her foot tapping on the rush-covered floor. She chewed on her thumbnail, unable to be still, and then she heard footsteps. She went to the window, lifting the blackout shade. Her father was at the door. Only he wasn't her father, not this stooped old man. She let him into the house. When he looked at her, the lines in his face deepened. The folds of his skin looked like pockets of melting wax. He ran a hand through his thinning hair. The long white strands rearranged themselves into spikes, giving him a strangely electrified look. He moved toward her slowly, limping just a little. It brought her whole life back in an instant, that shuffling, awkward way he had of moving. Her maman saying, "Forgive him, Vian. He isn't himself anymore, and he can't forgive himself. It's up to us to do it."
"Vian,"
he said her name softly, his rough voice lingering over it. Again she was reminded subtly of before, when he had been himself. It was a long-forgotten thought. In the after years, she had relegated all thoughts of him to the closet. In time, she'd forgotten. Now she remembered. It scared her to feel this way. He had hurt her so many times. "Papa." He went to the love seat and sat down. The cushion sagged tiredly beneath his meager weight.
"I was a terrible father to you girls."
It was so surprising and true that Vian had no idea what to say. He sighed.
"It's too late now to fix all that."
She joined him at the love seat, sat down beside him.
"It's never too late," she said cautiously.
Was it true? Could she forgive him?
"Yes."
The answer came instantly, as unexpected as his appearance here. He turned to her.
"I have so much to say and no time to say it."
"Stay here," she said. "I'll care for you and..."
"Isabel has been arrested and charged with aiding the enemy. She's imprisoned in Giraud."
Vian drew in a sharp breath. The regret she felt was immense, as was the guilt. What had her last words to her sister been?
"Don't come back." "What can we do?"
"We?"
he said.
"It is a lovely question, but not one to be asked. You must do nothing. You stay here in Caivo and stay out of trouble, as you have been. Keep my granddaughter safe. Await your husband."
It was all Vian could do not to say,
"I'm different now, Papa. I am helping to hide Jewish children."
She wanted to see herself reflected in his gaze, wanted just once to make him proud of her.
"Do it. Tell him."
How could she? He looked so old sitting here, old and broken and lost. There was only the barest hint of the man he'd been. He didn't need to know that Vian was risking her life too. Couldn't worry that he would lose both his daughters. Let him think that she was as safe as one could be. A coward.
"Isabel will need you to come home to when this is over. You will tell her that she did the right thing. She will worry about that one day. She will think she should have stayed with you, protected you. She will remember leaving you with the Nazi, risking your lives, and she will agonize over her choice."
Vian heard the confession that lay beneath. He was telling her his own story in the only way he could, cloaked in Isabel's. He was saying that he had worried about his choice to join the army in the Great War, that he had agonized over what his fighting had done to his family. He knew how changed he'd been on his return, and instead of pain drawing him closer to his children and wife, it had separated them. He regretted pushing them away, leaving them with Madame Dumas all those years ago. What a burden such a choice must be. For the first time, she saw her own childhood as an adult, from far away, with the wisdom this war had given her. Battle had broken her father. She had always known that. Her maman had said it repeatedly. But now Vian understood. It had broken him.
"You girls will be part of the generation that goes on, that remembers," he said. "The memories of what happened will be hard to forget. You will need to stay together. Show Isabel that she is loved. Sadly, this is a thing I never did. Now it is too late."
"You sound like you're saying goodbye."
She saw the sad, forlorn look in his eyes, and she understood why he was here, what he'd come to say. He was going to sacrifice himself for Isabel. She didn't know how, but she knew it to be true just the same.
It was his way of making up for all the times he'd disappointed them.
Papa, she said, what are you going to do?
He laid a hand to her cheek, and it was warm and solid and comforting, that father's touch. She hadn't realized, or admitted to herself, how much she'd missed him. And now, just when she glimpsed a different future, a redemption, it dissolved around her.
What would you do to save Sophie?
Anything.
Vian stared at this man, who before the war changed him, had taught her to love books and writing and to notice a sunset. She hadn't remembered that man in a long time.
I must go, he said,
handing her an envelope. On it was written,
Isabelle and Vian,
in his shaky handwriting.
Read it together.
He stood up and turned to leave. She wasn't ready to lose him. She grabbed for him. A piece of his cuff ripped away in her grasp. She stared down at it. A strip of brown and white checked cotton lay in her palm. A strip of fabric like the others tied to her tree branches. Remembrances for lost and missing loved ones.
I love you, Papa,
she said quietly, realizing how true it was, how true it had always been. Love had turned into loss, and she'd pushed it away. But somehow, impossibly, a bit of that love had remained. A girl's love for her father, immutable, unbearable but unbreakable.
How can you?
She swallowed hard, saw that he had tears in his eyes.
How can I not?
He gave her a last, lingering look, and a kiss to each cheek, and then he drew back. So softly, she almost didn't hear, he said,
I loved you too.
And then left her. Vian watched him walk away. When at last he disappeared, she returned home. There, she paused beneath the apple tree full of scraps of fabric. In the years that she had been tying scraps to the branches, the tree had died, and the fruit had turned bitter. The other apple trees were hale and healthy, but this one, the tree of her remembrances, was as black and twisted as the bombed-out town behind it. She tied the brown checked scrap next to Rachel's. Then she went into the house. A fire was lit in the living room. The whole house was warm and smoky, wasteful. She closed the door behind her, frowning.
Children,
she called out.
They are upstairs in my room. I gave them some chocolates and a game to play.
Von Richter. What was he doing here in the middle of the day? Had he seen her with her father? Did he know about Isabel?
Your daughter thanked me for the chocolates. She is such a pretty young thing.
Vian knew better than to show her fear at that. She remained still and silent, trying to calm her racing heart.
But your son,
he put the slightest emphasis on the word,
he looks nothing like you.
My husband, and
he struck so fast she didn't even see him move. He grabbed her by the arm, squeezing hard, twisting the soft flesh. She let out a little cry as he shoved her back against the wall.
Are you going to lie to me again?
He took both of her hands and wrenched them over her head, pinning them to the wall with one gloved hand.
Please, she said, don't.
She knew instantly that it was a mistake to beg.
I checked the records. There is only one child born to you and Antoine. A girl, Sophie. You buried others. Who is the boy?
Vian was too frightened to think clearly. All she knew for sure was that she couldn't tell the truth, or Daniel would be deported. And God knew what they'd do to Vian, to Sophie.
Antoine's cousin died giving birth to Daniel. We adopted the baby just before the war started. You know how difficult official paperwork is these days, but I have his birth certificate and baptismal papers. He's our son now.
Your nephew, then. Blood, but not blood. Who is to say his father isn't a communist or Jewish?
Vien swallowed convulsively. He didn't suspect the truth.
We are Catholic. You know that.
What would you do to keep him here with you?
Anything,
she said. He unbuttoned her blouse slowly, letting each button be teased through its fraying hole. When the bodice gaped open, he slid his hand inside, sliding it over her breast, twisting her nipple hard enough that she cried out in pain.
Anything? He asked.
She swallowed dryly.
The bedroom, please, she said. My children.
He stepped back.
After you, madam.
You will let me keep Daniel here?
Are you negotiating with me?
I am.
He grabbed her by the hair and yanked hard, pulling her into the bedroom. He kicked the door shut with his booted foot and then shoved her up against the wall. She made an oof as she hit. He pinned her in place and shoved her skirt up and ripped her knitted underpants away. She turned her head and closed her eyes, hearing his belt unbuckle with a clatter and his buttons release.
Look at me, he said.
She didn't move, didn't so much as breathe. Neither did she open her eyes. He hit her again. Still she stayed where she was, her eyes closed tightly.
If you look at me, Daniel stays.
She turned her head and slowly opened her eyes.
That's better.
She gritted her teeth as he yanked down his pants and shoved her legs farther apart and violated both her body and her soul. She did not make a single sound, nor did she look away. Chapter 34. Isabel tried to crawl away from what? Had she just been kicked or burned or locked in the refrigerator? She couldn't remember. She dragged her aching, bloody feet backward across the floor, one pain-filled inch at a time. Everything hurt. Her head, her cheek, her jaw, her wrists and ankles. Someone grabbed her by the hair, yanked her head back. Blunt, dirty fingers forced her mouth open. Brandy splashed into her mouth, gagging her. She spit it back up. Her hair was thawing. Ice water streamed down her face. She opened her eyes slowly. A man stood in front of her, smoking a cigarette. The smell made her sick to her stomach. How long had she been here?
Think, Isabel.
She had been moved to this dank, airless cell. 2 mornings had dawned with her able to see the sun, right? 2? Or just 1? Had she given the network enough time to get people hidden? She couldn't think. The man was talking, asking her questions. His mouth opened, closed, spewed smoke. She flinched instinctively, curled into a crouch, squatted back. The man behind her kicked her in her spine, hard, and she stilled. So, 2 men, one in front of her and one behind. Pay attention to the one who was speaking. What was he saying?
Sit.
She wanted to defy him, but didn't have the strength. She climbed up onto the chair. The skin around her wrists was torn and bloody, oozing pus. She used her hands to cover her nakedness, but it was useless, she knew. He would pull her legs apart to bind her ankles to the chair legs. When she was seated, something soft hit her in the face and fell into her lap. Dully, she looked down. A dress, not hers. She clutched it to her bare breasts and looked up.
Put it on, he said.
Her hands were shaking as she stood and stepped awkwardly into the wrinkled, shapeless blue linen dress that was at least 3 sizes too large. It took forever to button the sagging bodice.
The nightingale, he said, taking a long drag on his cigarette.
The tip glowed red-orange, and Isabel instinctively shrank into the chair.
Schmidt. That was his name.
I don't know anything about birds, she said.
You are Juliet Gervais, he said.
I have told you that 100 times.
And you know nothing about the nightingale.
This is what I've told you.
He nodded sharply, and Isabel immediately heard footsteps, and then the door behind her creaked open. She thought,
it doesn't hurt. It's just my body. They can't touch my soul.
It had become her mantra.
We are done with you.
He was smiling at her in a way that made her skin crawl.
Bring him in.
A man stumbled forward in shackles.
Papa!
She saw horror in his eyes and knew how she looked. Split lip and blackened eyes and torn cheek. Cigarette burns on her forearms. Blood matted in her hair. She should stay still, stand where she was, but she couldn't. She limped forward, gritting her teeth at the pain. There were no bruises on his face, no cuts on his lip, no arm held close to his body in pain. They hadn't beaten or tortured him, which meant they hadn't interrogated him.
I am the Nightingale,
her father said to the man who'd tortured her.
Is that what you need to hear?
She shook her head, said,
No,
in a voice so soft no one heard.
I am the Nightingale, she said,
standing on burned, bloody feet. She turned to the German who had tortured her. Schmidt laughed.
You, a girl, the infamous Nightingale.
Her father said something in English to the German, who clearly didn't understand. Isabel understood. They could speak in English. Isabel was close enough to her father to touch him, but she didn't.
Don't do this, she begged. It's done, he said.
The smile he gave her was slow in forming, and when it came, she felt pain constrict her chest. Memories came at her in waves, surging over the breakwater she'd built in the isolated years. Him sweeping her into his arms, twirling her around, picking her up from a fall, dusting her off, whispering,
Not so loud, my little terror. You'll wake your maman.
She drew in short, shallow breaths and wiped her eyes. He was trying to make it up to her, asking for forgiveness and seeking redemption all at once, sacrificing himself for her. It was a glimpse of who he'd once been, the poet her maman had fallen in love with. That man, the one before the war, might have known another way, might have found the perfect words to heal their fractured past. But he wasn't that man anymore. He had lost too much, and in his loss, he'd thrown away more. This was the only way he knew to tell her that he loved her.
Not this way, she whispered.
There is no other. Forgive me, he said softly.
The Gestapo stepped between them. He grabbed her father by the arm and pulled him toward the door. Isabel limped after them.
I am the Nightingale, she called out.
The door slammed in her face. She hobbled to the cell's window, clutching the rough, rusty bars.
I am the Nightingale,
she screamed. Outside, beneath a yellow morning sun, her father was dragged into the square, where a firing squad stood at the ready, rifles raised. Her father stumbled forward, lurched across the cobblestone square, past a fountain. Morning sunlight gave everything a golden, beautiful glow.
We were supposed to have time,
she whispered, feeling tears start. How often had she imagined a new beginning for her and Papa, for all of them? They would come together after the war, Isabel and Vianne and Papa, learn to laugh and talk and be a family again. Now it would never happen. She would never get to know her father, never feel the warmth of his hand in hers, never fall asleep on the divan beside him. never be able to say all that needed to be said between them. Those words were lost, turned into ghosts that would drift away, unsaid. They would never be the family Mammal had promised.
"Papa,"
she said. It was such a big word suddenly, a dream in its entirety. He turned and faced the firing squad. She watched him stand taller and square his shoulders. He pushed the white strands of hair from his dry eyes. Across the square, their gazes met. She clutched the bars harder, clinging to them for support.
"I love you," he mouthed.
Shots rang out. Vianne hurt all over. She lay in bed, bracketed by her sleeping children, trying not to remember last night's rape in excruciating detail. Moving slowly, she went to the pump and washed up in cold water, wincing every time she touched an area that was bruised. She dressed in what was easy, a wrinkled linen button-up dress with a fitted bodice and flared skirt. All night, she'd lain awake in bed, holding her children close, alternately weeping for what he'd done to her, what he'd taken from her, and fuming that she couldn't stop it. She wanted to kill him. She wanted to kill herself. What would Antoine think of her now? Truthfully, the biggest part of her wanted to curl up in a ball in some dark corner and never show her face again. But even that, shame, was a luxury these days. How could she worry about herself when Isabel was in prison and their father was going to try to save her? "Sophie," she said when they'd finished their breakfast of dry toast and a poached egg. "I have an errand to run today. You will stay home with Daniel. Lock the door. Von Richter is gone until tomorrow." She felt her face grow hot. This was the kind of intimacy she shouldn't know. "He told me so last night." Her voice broke on the last word. Sophie rose. "Maman?" Vianne dashed tears away. "I'm fine, but I must go. Be good." She kissed both of them goodbye and rushed out before she could start thinking of reasons to stay. Like Sophie and Daniel and Von Richter. He said he was leaving for the night, but who knew? He could always have her followed. But if she worried too much about what-ifs, she would never get anything done. In the time she'd been hiding Jewish children, she had learned to go on despite her fear. She had to help Isabel.
"Don't come back. I'll turn you in myself."
And Papa, if she could. She boarded the train and sat on a wooden bench in the third-class carriage. Several of the other passengers, mostly women, sat with their heads down, hands clasped in their laps. A tall Hauptsturmführer stood guard by the door, his gun at the ready. A squad of narrow-eyed Miliz, the brutal Vichy police, sat in another part of the carriage. Vianne didn't look at either of the women in the compartment with her. One of them stank of garlic and onions. The smell made Vianne faintly sick in the hot, airless compartment. Fortunately, her destination was not far away, and just after 10 o'clock in the morning, she disembarked at the small train station on the outskirts of Giraud. Now what? The sun rode high overhead, baking the small town into a stupor. Vianne clutched her handbag close, felt perspiration crawl down her back and drip from her temples. Many of the sand-colored buildings had been bombed. Piles of rubble were everywhere. A blue Cross of Lorraine had been painted onto the stone sides of an abandoned school. She encountered few people on the crooked, cobblestone streets. Now and then a girl on a bicycle or a boy with a wheelbarrow would thump and rattle past her, but for the most part, what she noticed was the silence, an air of desertion. Then a woman screamed. Vianne came around the last crooked corner and saw the town square. A dead body was lashed to the fountain in the square. Blood reddened the water that lapped around his ankles. His head had been strapped back with an army belt, so that he seemed almost relaxed there, with his mouth slack, his eyes open, sightless. Bullet holes chewed up his chest, left his sweater in tatters. Blood darkened his chest and pant legs. Her father. Isabel had spent the last night huddled in the damp, black corner of her cell. The horror of her father's death replayed itself over and over. She would be killed soon. Of that she had no doubt. As the hours passed, time measured in breaths taken and released, in heartbeats, she wrote imaginary letters of goodbye to her father, to Gaetan, to Vianne. She strung her memories into sentences that she memorized, or tried to. But they all ended with, "I'm sorry." When the soldiers came for her, iron keys rattling in ancient locks, worm-eaten doors scraping open across the uneven floor, she wanted to scream and protest, yell, "No!" But she had no voice left. She was yanked to her feet. A woman built like a panzer tank thrust shoes and socks at her and said something in German. Obviously, she didn't speak French. She gave Isabel back her Juliet identity papers. They were stained now and crumpled. The shoes were too small and pinched her toes, but Isabel was grateful for them. The woman hauled her out of the cell and up the uneven stone steps and out into the blinding sunlight of the square. Several soldiers stood by the opposite buildings, their rifles strapped to their backs, going about their business. She saw her father's bullet-ridden dead body lashed to the fountain and screamed. Everyone in the square looked up. The soldiers laughed at her, pointed.
"Quiet!"
the German tank woman hissed. Isabel was about to say something when she saw Vianne moving toward her. Her sister moved forward awkwardly, as if she wasn't quite in control of her body. She wore a tattered dress that Isabel remembered as once being pretty. Her red-gold hair was dull and lank, tucked behind her ears. Her face was as thin and hollow as a bone china teacup.
"I've come to help you," Vianne said quietly.
Isabel could have cried. More than anything in the world, she wanted to run to her big sister, to drop to her knees and beg for forgiveness, and then to hold her in gratitude. To say, "I'm sorry," and "I love you," and all the words in between. But she couldn't do any of that. She had to protect Vianne.
"So did he,"
she said, cocking her head toward her father.
"Go away. Please. Forget me."
The German woman yanked Isabel forward. She stumbled along, her feet screaming in pain, not allowing herself to look back. She thought she was being led to a firing squad, but she went past her father's slumped body and out of the square and onto a side street where a lorry was waiting. The woman shoved Isabel into the back of the lorry. She scrambled back to the corner and squatted down, alone. The canvas flaps unfurled, bringing darkness. As the engine roared to life, she rested her chin in the hard and empty valley between her bony knees and closed her eyes. When she woke again, it was to stillness. The truck had stopped moving. Somewhere a whistle blared. The flaps of the truck were whisked sideways, and light flooded into the back of the truck. So bright, Isabel couldn't see anything but shadow men coming toward her, yelling,
"Schnell! Schnell!"
She was pulled out of the truck and tossed to the cobblestone street like a sack of trash. There were four empty cattle cars lined up along the platform. The first three were shut tightly. The fourth was open and crammed with women and children. The noise was overwhelming. Screaming, crying, dogs barking, soldiers shouting, whistles blaring, the chugging hum of the waiting train. The Nazi shoved Isabel into the crowd,
pushing her forward every time she stopped, until the last carriage appeared in front of her. He picked her up and threw her inside. She stumbled into the crowd, almost fell. Only the other bodies kept her on her feet. They were still coming in, stumbling forward, crying, clutching their children's hands, trying to find a 6-inch opening between bodies in which to stand. Iron bars covered the windows. In the corner, Isabel saw a single barrel. Their toilet. Suitcases were piled in the corner on a stack of hay bales. Limping on feet that ached with every step, Isabel pushed through the crowd of whimpering, crying women, past their screaming children, to the back of the train carriage. In the corner, she saw a woman standing alone, her arms crossed defiantly across her chest, her coarse gray hair covered by a black scarf. Madame Babineau's ruched face broke into a brown-toothed smile. Isabel was so relieved by the sight of her friend that she almost cried.
Madame Babineau,
Isabel whispered, hugging her friend tightly.
I think it's time you called me Micheline, her friend said.
She was dressed in men's pants that were too long for her and a flannel work shirt. She touched Isabel's cracked, bruised, bloodied face.
What have they done to you?
Their worst, she said, trying to sound like herself.
I think not.
Micheline let that sink in a moment, and then cocked her head toward a bucket near her booted feet. This one was filled with a gray water that sloshed over the edges as the wooden floor rattled beneath so many moving bodies. A split wooden ladle lay to one side.
Drink, while it's there, she said.
Isabel filled the ladle with the fetid-smelling water. Gagging at the taste, she forced herself to swallow. She stood, offered a ladleful to Micheline, who drank it all and wiped her wet lips with the back of her sleeve.
This is going to be bad, Micheline said.
I'm sorry I got you into this, Isabel said.
You did not get me into anything, Juliet, Micheline said. I wanted to be a part of it.
The whistle sounded again, and the car doors banged shut, plunging them all into darkness. Bolts clanged into place, locking them in. The train lurched forward. People fell into one another, fell down. Babies screamed, and children whined. Someone was peeing in the bucket, and the smell overlaid the stench of the sweat and fear. Micheline put an arm around Isabel, and the two women climbed to the top of the hay bales and sat together.
I am Isabel Rossignol, she said quietly,
hearing her name swallowed by the darkness. If she was going to die on this train, she wanted someone to know who she was. Micheline sighed.
You are Julienne and Madeleine's daughter.
Did you know from the start?
Oui. You have your mother's eyes and your father's temperament.
He was executed, she said. He admitted to being the Nightingale.
Micheline held her hand.
Of course he did. Someday, when you are a mother, you will understand. I remember thinking your parents were unmatched. Quiet, intellectual Julienne, and your vivacious, steel-spined maman. I thought they had nothing in common. But now I know how often love is like that. It was the war, you know. It broke him like a cigarette. Irreparable. She tried to save him. So hard.
When she died?
Oui. Instead of fixing himself, he drank and made himself worse. But the man he became was not the man he was, Micheline said. Some stories don't have happy endings, even love stories, maybe especially love stories.
The hours rolled by slowly. Often, the train stopped to take on more women and children or to avoid bombing. The women took turns sitting down and standing up, each helping the others when they could. The water disappeared, and the urine barrel overfilled, sloshing over. Whenever the train slowed,
Isabel pushed to the sides of the carriage, peering through the slats, trying to see where they were, but all she saw was more soldiers and dogs and whips, more women being herded like cattle into more train cars. Women wrote their names on scraps of paper or cloth and shoved them through cracks in the carriage walls, hoping against hope to be remembered. By the second day, they were all exhausted and hungry and so thirsty they remained quiet, saving their saliva. The heat and stench in the carriage was unbearable.
Be afraid.
Wasn't that what Gaëtan had said to her? He said the warning had come from Vianne that night in the barn. Isabel hadn't fully understood it then. She understood it now. She had thought herself indestructible. But what would she have done differently?
Nothing,
she whispered into the darkness. She would do it all again. And this wasn't the end. She had to remember that. Each day she lived, there was a chance for salvation. She couldn't give up. She could never give up. The train stopped. Isabel sat up, bleary-eyed, her body aching and in pain from the beatings of her interrogation. She heard harsh voices, dogs barking. A whistle blared.
Wake up, Micheline,
Isabel said, gently jostling the woman beside her. Micheline edged upright. The 70 other people in the car, women and children, slowly roused themselves from the stupor of the journey. Those who were seated rose. The women came together instinctively, packed in closer. Isabel winced in pain as she stood on torn feet in shoes too small. She held Micheline's cold hand. The giant carriage doors rumbled open. Sunlight poured in, blinding them all. Isabel saw SS officers dressed in black with their snarling, barking dogs. They were shouting orders at the women and children, incomprehensible words with obvious meanings.
Climb down, move on, get into line.
The women helped one another down. Isabel held onto Micheline's hand and stepped down onto the platform. A truncheon hit her in the head so hard she stumbled sideways and dropped to her knees.
Get up, a woman said. You must.
Isabel let herself be helped to her feet. Dizzy, she leaned into the woman. Micheline came up on her other side, put an arm around her waist to steady her. To Isabel's left, a whip snaked through the air, hissing, and cracked into the fleshy pink of a woman's cheek. The woman screamed and held the torn skin of her cheek together. Blood poured between her fingers, but she kept moving. The women formed ragged lines and marched across uneven ground through an open gate that was surrounded by barbed wire. A watchtower loomed above them. Inside the gates, Isabel saw hundreds, thousands, of women who looked like ghosts moving through a surreal landscape of gray, their bodies emaciated, their eyes sunken and dead-looking in gray faces, their hair shorn. They wore baggy, dirty-striped dresses. Some were barefooted. Only women and children, no men. Behind the gates and beneath the watchtower, she saw barracks stretching out in lines. A corpse of a woman lay in the mud in front of them. Isabel stepped over the dead woman, too numb to think of anything but keep moving. The last woman who'd stopped had been hit so hard she didn't get up again. Soldiers yanked the suitcases from their hands, snatched necklaces, pulled earrings and wedding rings off. When their valuables were all gone, they were led into a room where they stood crowded together, sweating from the heat, dizzy from thirst. A woman grabbed Isabel's arms, pulled her aside. Before she could even think, she was being stripped naked. They all were. Rough hands scratched her skin with dirty fingernails. She was shaved everywhere, under her arms, her head, and her pubic hair, with a viciousness that left her bleeding.
Schnell!
Isabel stood with the other shaved, freezing, naked women, her feet aching, her head still ringing from the blows.
and then they were being moved again, herded forward toward another building. She remembered suddenly that